In March of the year 1244, 10,000 troops serving the Pope and the King of France huddled in their cold, wet camp in the Pyrenees, near the present-day border of France and Spain. For almost a year, this army had fruitlessly besieged a small mountaintop castle of Montségur. Trapped inside was a small band of fighting men, perhaps 50 to 100, and around 500 non-combatants. The besieged were among the last survivors of a religious sect known as the Cathars. Among the non-combatants were many of the elite of the Cathar faith, known as perfects or perfecti. Realizing their fate was sealed, the defenders of Montségur agreed to surrender. For decades, the Pope's crusaders had laid waste southern France in a ruthless campaign to stamp out the heresy. Whole cities had been put to the sword. With the surrender of Montségur, final victory seemed at hand. The crusaders constructed a massive pyre at the base of the rock. The Cathars, who renounced their sin and accepted absolution, would go free. But some 200 perfecti stubbornly refused. On March 16, 1244, as the pyre was lit, the condemned perfects embraced and walked into the flames singing hymns. They were leaving this world, and they were not coming back. In most history books, if the Cathars are mentioned at all, the fall of Montségur is portrayed as their last stand as an organized movement. But that's not really true. Heresies are hard things to kill. According to legend, prior to the surrender, three or four perfects escaped Montségur by secret passages. The escapees were said to have taken with them some kind of Cathar treasure. Just what that was, few could specify, and those who could, wouldn't. Some thought it was the Cathars' holy books, or gold and silver, or the Holy Grail, or maybe it was a person, the Cathars' secret leader. 11 years later, another royal host attacked the nearby castle of Keribus, where more Cathars and their perfects were holed up. But the attackers found the place deserted. The heretics had all slipped away. Where to? No one knew. Cathar bishops, the highest rank of the perfecti, were still active in the Pyrenees a half century later. In 1321, the last known perfect in France was put to death. Church officials in northern Italy burned another in 1340. Despite all the efforts of soldiers and inquisitors, despite a genocidal crusade, Catharism proved very hard to stamp out. What made this group so difficult to eradicate? And why was the Catholic Church determined to do so? Was it ever truly destroyed? Or did it just adapt and become invisible? It's much the same question that is also asked about many other secret societies in history, including the Assassins of Persia and the Knights Templar of the Crusades. The Cathars' redoubt of Montségur bears an uncanny resemblance to the mountain fortress of the Muslim Assassins, who flourished around the same time in present-day Iran. And the flaming pyre that consumed the Cathar perfects prefigures by less than a century the burning at the stake of the Knights Templar leader, Jacques de Molay. Coincidences? Probably. Or do they hint at cosmic correspondences that we can barely imagine? The Cathars, condemned as diabolical heretics by the Roman Church, are often hailed as a manifestation of a separate, primitive brand of Christianity, proto-Protestants, or enlightened harbingers of social and sexual equality. They've also been roped into the resurgence of Southern French or Occitanian cultural identity. If you travel to towns like Toulouse, Albi, and Carcassonne today, you'll see signs proclaiming the Pays Cathar, Cathar country, special Cathar tours, and prominent displays of the gold and red Cathar cross, which it isn't, as I'll explain later. Like many other secret orders down through time, the Cathars have been spun, co-opted, and mythologized, which makes sorting out exactly who they were and what they believed almost impossible. Indeed, like many secret societies, the Cathars leave open doors at both ends. They appear and disappear, with no definitive evidence of creation or destruction. Still, as a religious movement, one that must have had hundreds of thousands of followers, how can Catharism be called a secret society? As always, that comes down to inner doctrines as opposed to outward appearances. The name Cathar comes from the Greek term katharos, or pure. It's the same root as our modern term catharsis, meaning cleansing or release. But the Cathars never called themselves such. Indeed, they referred to themselves simply as bons chrétiens, good Christians, or bonhommes, good men. Despite the heretic label, the Cathars regarded themselves as Christians, the true Christians. An alternative name was Albigensian, taken from one of their main strongholds, Albi. Church officials also branded them Manichees for reasons we'll see. The essence of Cathar belief was that there wasn't one God, but two. It's called dualism. This solved that sticky problem of how a good God lets bad things happen. The good God, the Lord of light and mercy, rules the world of spirit, the celestial realm from which humankind's pure, immortal souls had fallen. What they fell into was the material world, a spiritual prison ruled by the evil God, the Demiurge, or more simply, Satan. In other words, we're trapped in hell. Everything in the material realm is corrupt, and our pure souls yearn to escape it. But we're condemned to this eternal rebirth in this cosmic hellhole through the allure of its seductive but false pleasures. None of these was more insidious than lust, which caused the creation of more fleshly prisons, babies, to trap more divine souls. The only way to escape the cycle was to reject the physical world, pleasures and all. If you think this sounds vaguely like Hinduism or Buddhism, you may be onto something. By its encouraging of reproduction and wallowing in wealth and privilege, Cathars saw the Catholic Church as a tool of the evil God. They reviled it as the Church of Wolves, a monstrosity of brick and mortar, sumptuousness and idolatry, which did nothing but mislead. Cathars rejected the Old Testament and identified Jehovah with the evil God. To them, the Holy Trinity was a lie. To the Cathars, Jesus was neither God nor man. He was a manifestation of the Holy Spirit sent by the good God to show us the way to freedom. So, naturally, the evil God had him destroyed. But the Cathars didn't believe that Christ was really flesh and blood. Rather, he was a kind of hologram. So in their view, there was no real crucifixion or resurrection, or virgin birth, because Jesus had no material form. To Cathars, the cross was a hateful symbol, which is why there's no such thing as a Cathar cross. It's easy to see why the Catholic Church would object to this, but that wasn't all. In contrast to the Catholic Church's cathedrals and abbeys, the Cathar Church had no fixed abodes. Worship could take place anywhere, outdoors or in private homes. Nor was there any Cathar pope or rapacious clergy. The highest level was bishop. The Cathar clergy were the perfects. Because foregoing the false pleasures of the world was something most simple souls couldn't manage, only a chosen few became perfecti. Even thinking about it meant a 3-year apprenticeship with a current perfect who had to find you worthy. After an initiation called the consolamentum, what you had to look forward to was a life of celibacy and nonviolence coupled with a strict vegetarian diet. You couldn't eat anything born of sexual intercourse. And poverty. Plus lots of wandering because the Perfecti were both the priesthood and the missionaries of the Cathar faith. It sounds not only like Buddhist monks, but also like the dais used by the assassins and other Shia sects. Are we looking at the same thing under different names? Most importantly, Perfects were role models for rank-and-file Cathars, the credentes, or believers. In return, the believers supported and obeyed the Perfecti, just like secret society underlings should. Credentes lived more or less regular lives and looked forward to receiving the consolamentum on their deathbed. Supposedly, if it looked like a consoled person might recover, they trusted their brethren to smother them to ensure that they departed the earthly realm sin-free. Besides the consolamentum, there was also a ritual suicide by starvation called the Endura. The basic Cathar ritual was a simple meal of broken bread and a mutual greeting between credentes and perfecti called the Melioramentum. The Mass and the cross played no part in any of this. But remember, much of what we do know about the Cathars has been handed down from their mortal enemies, the Catholic Church. There are mentions of Cathar holy books like the Book of Two Principles, the Secret Supper, and the Interrogation of John, but the Inquisition zealously destroyed them. Denying the heretics their gospels was seen as key to defeating them. Catholic critics frequently accuse the Cathars of witchcraft and sexual perversity. There isn't any real evidence of witchcraft, but there might be something to the perceived perversity. The Cathars' issue wasn't so much with sexual gratification as procreation. Thus, masturbation and homosexuality may have been condoned as acceptable, if not desirable, practices. And then there was the fact that the Cathars ordained women alongside men and generally afforded them social and spiritual equality. Still, the Cathars ignored the Virgin Mary because the purely spiritual Christ had no mother. Yet they held Mary Magdalene in high esteem. This has led some to propose that the Cathars' big secret, their Holy Grail, was knowledge of a holy bloodline established by Jesus and Magdalene. A romantic theory, but it makes no sense because, remember, the Cathars didn't believe Jesus was a physical being. As a visible movement, Catharism lasted about 250 years. But it was part of a much wider phenomenon that embodied beliefs and practices dating back hundreds, maybe thousands of years, and which survived long after Catharism vanished. As I mentioned earlier, Catholics frequently referred to Cathars as Manichees, and the Cathar Church as a revival of Manichaeism. This was a dualistic religion founded by the Persian prophet Mani in the 3rd century AD. It was one of the main rivals of Christianity during the later Roman Empire. Manichaeism, as an organized faith, seemingly died out around 500. So how could it pop up in France hundreds of years later? But Cathar roots may go back further, to the Pythagorean Brotherhood, a mystical secret society that appeared in Greece and Italy around 500 BC. Like the Cathars, Pythagoreans believed that divine souls were trapped in a corrupt material world, and that their ultimate goal was to break the cycle of reincarnation and return to the celestial realm. They also practiced asceticism and vegetarianism and initiated women. Catharism probably wasn't a direct descendant of Pythagoreanism, but they did share a common root in Gnosticism. Gnosticism is more philosophy than religion or cult. There's pagan Gnosticism, Christian Gnosticism, even Jewish and Islamic Gnosticism. Gnosticism holds that the key to enlightenment and salvation is knowledge, gnosis, rather than faith or grace. Illumination allows one to achieve union with the true divine through realization of one's own divine nature. Though it isn't exactly what Cathars believe, you can see the similarities. Another thread in the Cathar tapestry goes back to the Zoroastrian religion of ancient Persia. Again, it formed around 500 BC and featured a Lord of Light and a Lord of Darkness battling for control of the world. Zoroastrianism, in turn, influenced the later prophet Mani. If you look at all the religions and esoteric traditions floating around the Near East in the 3rd century AD and put them into a blender, you'd come up with something like Manichaeism. Mani's faith featured a spiritual realm of light and a material world of darkness run by rival gods, with captive souls struggling to escape corrupt matter and return to the light. Like the Cathars, Manichaeism had an inner core of initiated elect who ministered to a broad base of lay hearers. The prophet Mani, born in present-day Iraq, was raised in a Jewish Christian Gnostic sect. Inspired by visions, he proclaimed himself the reincarnation of Jesus, Zoroaster, Buddha, and even the Hindu Krishna. Today, we tend to identify Buddhism with East Asia. But the faith originated in India, and as Mani shows, its influence was well established in the Middle East by Roman times. It's no stretch to argue that its influence also spread to Europe. So when the French historian Zoe Oldenburg suggests the Cathars were basically Western Buddhists, she might be right. Regardless, Manichaeism influenced a bewildering array of sects and heresies during the early Middle Ages. In the 7th century, the Eastern Christian Byzantine Empire waged a bloody war against the so-called Paulician heresy. Paulicians also followed the dualist good God versus evil God track and rejected the official church. Like the Cathars, the Paulicians believed Jesus was an avatar of the good God. But unlike the Cathars, Paulicians had no elect or perfecti. They apparently placed no value on asceticism, chastity, or vegetarianism. The Paulicians did, however, go in for egalitarianism and violent social revolution, rejecting not just the Orthodox Church, but the whole Byzantine social and political order. Traces of this rebel spirit is evident in the Cathars. In the late 900s, the Paulician heresy was militarily crushed, and the Byzantine emperors settled thousands of supposedly repentant heretics in their Balkan provinces. And guess what? A new dualist heresy sprouted there almost immediately. Called the Bogomils, the Beloved of God, the sect spread rapidly in present-day Bulgaria, Serbia, and Bosnia. Doctrinally, Bogomilism and Catharism were almost identical, though the Bogomils turned Jesus and Satan, the evil God, into brothers and sons of the ultimate good God. The question is whether we're looking at chain transmission. Manichaeism inspires Paulicianism, which inspires Bogomilism, which inspires Catharism, or at the spontaneous generation of similar sects inspired by some unseen common source. Sufi scholar Idris Shah proposed that the Hidden Hand was a secret Gnostic organization that manifested in many forms before and after the rise of Christianity. Its symbol, he argued, was a rooster-headed, snake-limbed deity known as Abraxas. The name Abraxas shows up in Kabbalah, a form of Jewish mysticism widely adopted by Gnostic Christians and others. The ultimate goal of the Gnostic secret society, Idris Shah believed, was the creation of an enlightened elite. The basic aim was to undermine existing religious and social inhibitions to create an environment in which gnosis and enlightenment could flourish. But as Shah put it, these secretive Gnostics could subscribe to the outward doctrines of any religion and operate under many political religious systems, all the while working to destroy them. The subversive conspirators might encourage sexual liberation in one place and sexual abstinence in another. From this perspective, doctrine was meaningless. Experience was everything. Curiously, another secret order, the medieval Persian assassins, had the credo of nothing is true, everything is permitted. Could the assassins have been another aspect of this vast Gnostic conspiracy? Well, maybe. And could the same be true for those controversial 12th century crusaders, the Knights Templar? Historian Stephen Runciman points to yet another obscure Gnostic sect, the Messalians, which appeared in Syria around the 4th century AD. Runciman suspected the Messalians had preserved secret traditions and secret books that were later passed on to the 10th century Bogomils. Syrian Messalians used ritual initiation to create a perfecti-like elite. Also, like the Bogomils and Cathars, they abhorred the cross, the Old Testament, its God, and the churches based on them. The Messalians also proselytized through vagabond preachers, the same as Bogomils and Cathars would do centuries later. A problem with the chain transmission theory is that while Pelusianism thrived mostly among Armenians, Bogomilism spread almost exclusively among Slavs and Catharism among the Latinized peoples of France and Italy. It's almost as if these were variants generated for specific cultural communities. Researchers Graham Hancock and Robert Boval also provocatively speculate that Bogomils and Cathars were part of a well-planned and coordinated plot. The Bogomils' aim was thought to be the overthrow of the Roman and Eastern Christian churches, along with the feudal, hierarchical societies that they served. In its place, they aimed to create a new world order, free of throne and pulpit. Hancock and Boval claimed that Italian Cathars had a well-organized system to infiltrate capable students into church-run universities. These interlopers diligently studied logic and theology, all with the ultimate goal of using them against the Catholic faith. Another theory is that Catharism and kindred heresies were survivals of an original primitive Christianity. This was the supposed true church before it was taken over and perverted by a self-serving cabal of bishops, pontiffs, and patriarchs. Hancock and Boval even argue that early Christianity was overwhelmingly Gnostic and Catharism but one manifestation. References to a primitive true Christianity also crop up among Masonic and Neo-Templar groups in the 18th and 19th centuries. Was that imitation or continuity? But let's take a closer look at chronology. Bogomilism appeared in the Balkans around 950, supposedly through the efforts of a single wandering priest. Barely 50 years later, a Manichae heresy, not yet dubbed Catharism, existed as far west as the Rhineland, Flanders, and France. Its original appearance seems to have been more or less simultaneous with Bogomilism. By 1020, an early Cathar sect was reported in the Limousin region of central France, but then it seemed to die out or go underground and doesn't get mentioned for another century, when it's then condemned as a pernicious threat at a church council in Toulouse. During the 12th century, the heresy spread like wildfire, especially in the Occitania and Provence regions of southern France, and in the neighboring parts of northern Spain and Italy. But an attempt by 24 German prefects to infiltrate into England in 1166 failed when they were caught and put to death. At almost the same time, Cathar communities in France and Italy received an important visitor from the East. He was Father Nicetas, the Bogomil bishop of Constantinople. Nicetas acted very much the boss. He rebuked the Cathar bishop of Lombardy for straying from the strict dualist line and forced him to recant. In 1167, Nicetas convened a general conference near Toulouse, where he reconsecrated all the bishops and prefecti in the proper rite and consecrated 3 new bishops for the expanding franchise. This clearly shows that the Cathars regarded the Bogomils as some kind of mother church. So, by 1200, a Gnostic anti-church, with at least 16 bishoprics, stretched from the Black Sea to the Atlantic Ocean. It still leaves the question of whether Nicetas acted on his own authority or on someone else's. Was there a Bogomil old man of the mountain somewhere, like Hassan Isabah of the Assassins, invisibly calling the shots from his castle? The reasons Catharism spread so quickly were both cultural and political. France, as we know it today, didn't exist. The northern area around Paris was semi-civilized. The southern lands of Occitania and Provence, also called Languedoc, gave lip service to royal authority, but spoke their own language and retained much of the old Roman culture. An example is found in the wandering troubadours who promoted courtly love among the upper classes. Courtly love emphasized the virtue of chaste romantic longing over carnal sex. And this notion fit very well with Cathar views on love and procreation. Was that coincidental? Or were troubadours part of the Cathar propaganda machine? In any case, Cathar leaders understood the value of sucking up to the well-connected. Powerful local rulers, such as Count Raymond of Toulouse, granted the Cathar church toleration and protection. Among known perfects, almost a third were of noble origin. The Vatican eventually sat up and took notice. In 1208, Pope Innocent III sent a papal legate to Toulouse to reconvert the heretics. The legate's murder, probably at the instigation of the pro-Cathar Count Raymond of Toulouse, set off the so-called Albigensian Crusade. It raged for the next 20 years. An army of 20,000 northern crusaders descended on Languedoc with fire and sword. An early indication of what was to come was the sack of Béziers in 1209. The town was the home of many Cathars and of ordinary Catholics as well. The crusaders who stormed the walls asked another papal representative, Arnaud Amare, how they could tell good Christians from the heretics. Amare issued the order that still echoes today, kill them all, and God will know his own. It's said that 20,000 were butchered in Béziers, including 7,000 cut down while praying in the town cathedral. Though skeptics argue the cathedral couldn't hold that many people. By the time peace was signed, in 1229, the south was devastated, with 500,000 to 1 million people dead and the power of its nobles crushed. This did much to increase the power of the king in Paris. But the war against Catharism wasn't over, as became clear in the 1244 siege of Montségur. But the struggle changed. The Cathars now had to truly become a secret society, and the Catholic Church, to root it out, formed a secret society of its own, the Inquisition. For the next 100 years, the secret police of the Vatican conducted a ruthless campaign of extermination against the Cathar underground, burning their perfects and their books wherever they were found. Repentant credentes were forced to wear a yellow cross and live apart from other Christians. The heretics were amazingly resilient and preserved a large number of secret supporters among the population. There was even a brief Cathar resurgence in the Pyrenees in the early 1300s. But thereafter, the once powerful sect just seems to fade away. Or did it? As I mentioned, there are many interesting parallels between the Shias of Islam and the Gnostics of Christendom. Many Shia practiced taqiyya, or dissimulation, which allowed them to publicly deny their faith while keeping it privately. Did the Cathars do the same? One theory is that the Cathars blended into various organizations that sprang up on the fringes of the official church. For instance, around 1307, in the mountains of northern Italy, the renegade Catholic monk Fra Dolcino, led a 1,000-strong band in a bloody struggle against the church and local nobility. It's interesting that Dolcino's band made their stand on the Piano dei Gazzari, the plateau of the Cathars, and they were called Cathars by the locals. Like the Cathars, Dolcino practiced gender equality, and like the Paulicians, he preached egalitarianism and primitive communism. That said, there's no evidence of dualism in Dolcino's teaching. The true origins of the Cathars are lost in time, yet it's clear they didn't spring from nothing. The Cathars inherited and adapted much older beliefs, and they undoubtedly influenced other groups to come.